This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Conference on Human Rights and Labor Rights, featuring speakers Scott Nova, Executive Director of Workers' Rights Consortium from Washington, D.C., and Leanna Foxfog of Sweat Free Communities from Massachusetts. This event is presented by the PSU Progressive Student Union and the Coalition of Campus and Community Groups, and it takes place on Monday, October 17th at 7 p.m. at the PSU Multicultural Center. For more information, please email lc@pdx.edu or call 503-471-7798.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, sourcing, selecting, and blending teas since 1966. 1-800-999-2122 or www.peets.com.
KBOO in Portland. I'm Julie
Sabatier.
KBOO's
FIFA
Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Dillon Dedos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Diller, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland-based relief organizations are sending aid to hurricane-ravaged Guatemala. Hundreds of thousands gathered in Washington for the Millions More March Saturday, and two earthquakes shook Turkey earlier today.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 1,976 officially acknowledged deaths of Americans, with as many as 42,000 soldiers wounded. Among Iraqi civilians, it's estimated that as many as 29,000 people have been killed as a direct result of the war, while more than 100,000 others have died as a secondary result of the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 17th, 2005. I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. Oregon-based Mercy Corps, in partnership with the Northwest Medical Teams, is expanding the emergency relief effort in Guatemala following the October 8th tropical storm Stan. KBOO's Stephanie Potter has more.
Reports provided by the Mercy Corps assessment team today indicate that damage in Guatemala from tropical storm Stan may be worse than first thought. Air surveys are showing entire villages have been either completely washed away by floods or buried in mudslides, and some fear that it could be worse than Hurricane Mitch, which devastated the region in 1998. Eric Block of Mercy Corps says that right now his agency is still focusing on emergency relief aid.
So it's basic food, water, medical care, shelter supplies, tents. But there are also great long-term consequences that we're looking to deal with. The hurricane struck in some of Guatemala's most populous and most productive agricultural areas. So there will be food security issues that we're looking for, loss of income, particularly for the poor who are already vulnerable. Access to food and the price of food will be a real issue.
At least 100 communities have been affected, and Block said that over 1,000 people have died. More thousands have been reported injured. Northwest Medical Teams is working with Mercy Corps, and today four of their medical workers were able to begin treating patients. They had traveled to San Marcos, which has some of the worst damage. Beth Sethi of Northwest Medical explains.
San Marcos is some of the highest elevations in Guatemala, and so it's very mountainous. People built their towns right on the sides of the hills, and so the ground just became so saturated that literally villages have been wiped out by the mud.
Getting to the victims has been especially challenging.
It continues to rain, so they were originally going to travel in by helicopter, but they couldn't do that because it was raining too hard. Then they thought they would go by land, but most of the roads have been wiped out. So that was going to take them 3 days to go on an alternate, you know, very roundabout way. So finally what they did is the military, the Guatemalan military, flew them in on a cargo plane. And I believe they landed at an Air Force base near San Marcos, and then they traveled the rest of the way by car.
Dan Denver of the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee thinks it's also important to remember that the storm has taken place in a country that has endured 36 years of civil war.
The mainstream media's coverage of this tragedy isn't putting the storm in the context of the history of repression of indigenous people in that country. And that places hardest hit are also some of the historically poorest and most marginalized. Numerous places that were hit really hard by the storm are places with very recent bad memories of Guatemalan military massacres of their communities.
Sethi confirmed difficulties with the military.
The Mayan indigenous people still tend to view the military as associated with the military from 10 years ago that was persecuting them. And so in some cases, in some villages, I've heard reports that that the villagers were actually refusing to allow the military to come in and help them dig bodies out of the mud. But our team has not encountered that yet, to my knowledge.
Mercy Corps has been in Guatemala for 5 years and has a staff of 50 in the country, working to improve health care, develop local non-governmental organizations, and resolve long-standing land disputes. The Northwest Medical Team has been there a year, helping the Mercy Corps with a dental program. To help with the Central American Flooding Fund, call 1-800-852-2100 or go to www.mercycorps.org. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
A Clackamas County grand jury is meeting today to decide if the police were justified in fatally shooting a naked, unarmed man. Officers shot and killed Fouad Kady when he was wandering naked and rowdy on Southeast 362nd Avenue in Sandy last month. The officers received a report of a hit-and-run car accident and arrived to find Kady naked. Police say they tried to get the 27-year-old under control, but he became combative. Officers tried to taser him, but were unable to get Kady to calm down. At one point, Kady got up on top of a patrol vehicle, which is when at least one of the officers shot him. Kady died at the scene. About a dozen protesters carrying signs outside the Clackamas County Court building criticizing police for shooting the naked, unarmed man.
Adair Village, a small community near Corvallis, is considering what may be the first all-volunteer police force in Oregon. Many towns have all-volunteer fire departments. But the Oregon Department of Public Safety Standards and Training says there has never been an all-volunteer police department. Without a model to follow, Adair Village faces questions about how to provide insurance and certification for officers, and whether such a department is even possible. Several residents, including six with police experience, are willing to patrol their community for free. The Adair Village City Council will take it over at a meeting this week.
The Bureau of Land Management announced its new plan for Central Oregon, including the proposed Badlands Wilderness Area. It could mean a change for all lands in the West. KBOO's Noah Eaton reports.
A historic agreement between the Bureau of Land Management and conservationists bans motorized vehicles from the Badlands Wilderness Area. But in a move that could change the way all western lands are managed, it also includes a new plan allowing ranchers to voluntarily give up their grazing permits in the area, allowing other uses. Bill Marlett with the Oregon Natural Desert Association says this is good news.
They never had a process by which the rancher could turn around and turn their permits back into BLM or the Forest Service and have those agencies recognize the arrangement that had been reached.
Marlett says this agreement now allows interested groups to, quote, buy out ranchers' permits.
Badlands is now being managed better than a lot of BLM wildernesses in the West, by virtue of the fact that we now have roughly two-thirds of it cow-free.
The proposed Badlands Wilderness Area is 15 miles east of Bend. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I am Noah Eaton, KBOO News.
The FBI is investigating the recent theft of a ceremonial tomahawk in Walla Walla, Washington. It is believed to be the weapon used to kill Dr. Marcus Whitman, the 19th century missionary and one of the leaders of the Northwest Settlement. Whitman and his wife Narcissa were killed by Cayuse warriors in 1847. The tribe blamed the Whitmans for a deadly measles epidemic. The Tomahawk disappeared from a display case during visiting hours at the Whitman Mission National Historical Site in southeastern Washington. Chief of Interpretation at the site, Roger Trick, says the thief used a special tool to dismantle the case. Trick says someone brought in exactly the right size wrench. A criminal investigator for the National Park Service says there are no leads or suspects.
The current time is 5:10:30. And still to come on the KBOO Evening News, a riot broke out in Toledo, Ohio Saturday, provoked by a march planned by a group of neo-Nazis. A budget bill before Congress this week could be bad news for the social welfare programs. Israel suspended negotiations with Palestinian Authority as violence in the region increased today. You're listening to the Community Radio, KBOO, in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
The Atlantic Ocean hurricane season tied a 1933 record for the busiest ever as Tropical Storm Wilma strengthened, heading towards Honduras and Mexico, causing crude oil and natural gas prices to rise. The system, which formed today over the Caribbean Sea, is the 21st named tropical storm of the 2005 hurricane season. It is forecasted to strengthen tomorrow as it moves west toward Honduras, Belize, and Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, possibly becoming a hurricane by tomorrow evening. There are 6 weeks left in the June 1st to November 30th hurricane season. Katrina was the costliest ever U.S. natural disaster when it slammed into Louisiana in August, killing about 1,250 people. Spain was hit this month by its first tropical cyclone ever. All the letters of the alphabet except Q, U, X, Y, and Z are used to name storms. After Wilma, the storms will be named for letters in the Greek alphabet: Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, and so on.
Hurricane Katrina floodwaters have receded and the beginnings of a cleanup are underway in New Orleans, but differing visions of how to rebuild are already creating conflict. Many public housing residents face immediate eviction, with no alternative housing being offered. FSRN's Jenka Soderberg reports from New Orleans.
Residents of Forest Park Apartments in New Orleans have staged a rally and takeover of the apartment management office to challenge the management's forced removal of the residents over the weekend. Ms. Charlestine Jones is a resident of Forest Park.
We found our place to be livable, and we all were trying to get an understanding from the landlord as to why couldn't we just stay in one area until they repair one side and move over to the next side. She said we couldn't do this. We needed to all evacuate, even without having a place to go. If we didn't have ourselves out by Sunday, that they were going to just put us out on the curb.
In the face of Hurricane Katrina, Governor Kathleen Blanco declared that there would be a stay on all housing evictions until the 25th of October. Residents claim that even if they are given until the 25th, there is no alternative housing available in the New Orleans area. Jay Manning is a community organizer with the C3, Caring Community Compassion Coalition, in New Orleans.
The Housing Authority of New Orleans residents, over 32,000, have not been able to come back to their apartments. They're all African American. They could move back immediately. Why is it not happening? We say because there's wealthy developers, the Cannizzaros, the Kabakoffs, and the hotel industry that have been gunning for that property for years, and they are using this strategy to put through their final solution, to grab it, turn it into high-priced condos, yes, and to drive out the African-American working-class community there.
The problems faced by public housing tenants in New Orleans did not begin with Hurricane Katrina. Over the past year, residents of the Iberville Housing Project near the French Quarter have been fighting to keep their public housing open. Mike Howell, with the Hands Off Iberville Coalition, questions the commission Mayor Nagin has put together to plan the rebuilding of New Orleans, saying that there is an overrepresentation of housing developers on the commission. Mike Howell.
First of all, there are three guys who are identified as developers, but there's a fourth one, the co-chair, Barbara Majors, who works hand in glove with Joe Cannizzaro, who's one of the leading developers here. Cannizzaro and Majors worked with the gentrifiers to destroy the St. Thomas housing complex, which many of those people who were kicked out of St. Thomas a couple years ago ended up in the lower Ninth Ward and other areas that were flooded. God knows how many of those people died. And we don't want any more tragedies like that. Certainly all the public housing in the city center, where most of it used to be, is a safe area. And we want the public housing reopened.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jenka Soderberg in New Orleans.
Louisiana is conducting an investigation into whether critically ill patients were left to die or were euthanized at a New Orleans hospital during the chaotic aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. The investigation is part of a probe into an estimated 215 deaths at nursing homes and hospitals across the area, according to the Louisiana Department of Health and Hospitals. The Louisiana Attorney General's office, which is overseeing the inquiry, is examining what happened to patients and residents at 19 hospitals and nursing homes. The scope of the probe now includes 21% of the 1,035 Louisiana deaths linked to the hurricane. A doctor at New Orleans Memorial Medical Center alleged that some of the 45 patients who died there might have been euthanized to end their suffering. The doctor, Bryant King, told CNN last week that he had heard discussions among Memorial staff members about euthanizing some critically ill patients after power went out and conditions deteriorated in the hospital. New Orleans Parish Coroner Frank Mignard said that his staff has examined all but a half dozen of the bodies from Memorial and that nothing obviously suspicious has been found.
Hundreds of thousands gathered to hear Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan and others and speak at the Millions More March movement here on Sunday. Speakers in Washington touched on issues concerning health care, economic disparities, and response to Hurricane Katrina. FSRN's Selena Musada brings us the voices from the rally.
10 years ago at the Million Man March, Jim Embrum pledged with crowds of black men and boys to take personal responsibility of their families and communities. This year, Embrum traveled with a friend from Detroit, Michigan, with the hope that the Millions More movement would provide solutions to the hardships facing African-American communities.
We came here 10 years ago, a lot of great speakers, a lot of emotion, a lot of discussion of the plight of African-Americans. But we left here without, in my view, enough structure, enough plans, enough solutions. For what should be the work over the next 10 years.
The 1995 march targeted only black men, but this march was open to all men and women of different racial backgrounds. Safiza Nettleton brought her son from New York.
I came to the march, you know, because I just felt the need to, you know, be around a lot of people that were like me and that was looking for a more progressive community and a more progressive people and a people that loved each other, because I really think that we are in trouble as a black nation.
Not all who wanted to be at the march felt welcomed. FSRN reported last week that Minister Louis Farrakhan met with the National Black Justice Coalition, or NBJC, a black lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender civil rights group, and said he would allow Keith Boykin, president of the NBJC, to speak as an openly gay man at the rally. The night before the march, chief organizer of the Millions More Movement March, Reverend Willie Wilson, took Boykin off the speaker's list. Tara Lake expressed her anger and disappointment.
It's not enough for us to toil and then to be disrespected and then to be maligned and then to be threatened when it becomes convenient for leadership. And so we're here in support, and we're also here to demand a place.
More than 100 black lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgenders marched through the Millions More movement, chanting and holding signs, calling for recognition of their lives.
In the District of Columbia, this is Selena Masuta.
A riot broke out in Toledo, Ohio, Saturday, provoked by a march planned by a group of neo-Nazis through a predominantly black neighborhood. City authorities had granted a march permit to the National Socialist Movement, which brought a dozen members from out of town. The group calls itself America's Nazi Party. A spokesman for the group said it had come to the city because of black criminal behavior. According to the Toledo Blade, about 11 a.m., the group of uniformed neo-Nazis gathered on the east side of Woodward High School, shouting racist slogans and carrying signs reading, "White people unite, fight for your race." The Toledo police, some on horseback, were stationed nearby to protect the group. The neo-Nazis marched to nearby Woodrow Wilson Park. Just before noon, Toledo police began firing the first of many canisters of tear gas at local residents gathering to protest the march. The crowd, numbering now in the hundreds, began throwing bricks and rocks at buildings and passing vehicles, according to the Blade. Around noontime, police made a decision to cancel the march. The standoff between police and rioters, however, intensified. Initial estimates of damage were in the tens of thousands of dollars.
The Supreme Court, in an abortion case for a relatively narrow scope, cleared the way today for a Missouri prison inmate to terminate her pregnancy. The High Court decision was not a sweeping rendering of the on the issue of abortion, per se, but as a result, Missouri correction officials must drive the woman to a clinic to have the procedure. It was unclear how soon that would be done. Late Friday, Justice Clarence Thomas granted a temporary stay to the state, which prevented a woman from having an abortion on Saturday. But today, the High Court's action was unanimous. Missouri law forbids spending tax dollars to facilitate an abortion, but federal judge took the position that that the prison system in Missouri was blocking her from exercising her rights. The Department of Corrections said that it would follow the court's order that the procedure be allowed, but didn't yet know the practical details of when or how that might occur. The woman has not been identified. Her attorney, James Falakos of the American Civil Liberties Union, said in court papers that she is running out of time because she is 16 to 17 weeks pregnant, and Missouri bars abortions after 22 weeks.
Congress is expected to take up its budget reconciliation bill this week. The bill is poised to cut taxes by $70 billion while cutting tens of billions of dollars more in programs for the poor. FSRN's Mitch Jezerich reports from Washington, D.C.
Advocates for children in foster care are sounding the alarm bell over a potential $10 billion or more cut to the nation's health care program for the poor, known as Medicaid. It is Medicaid that pays for a vast majority of health care services for the some 800,000 kids who are in foster care. 22-year-old Daniela Wren is a former foster care child and current advocate with the Child Welfare League of America.
Those children that are aging out of foster care are, in most states, left without any medical coverage and age out of the foster care system with no support systems in place, no net, no safety net to catch them if they need medical care or mental health services.
A recent study by Harvard Medical School and the Casey Family Program suggests that over 50% of young adults like Daniela Wren, who had formerly been in foster care, will develop at least one major mental health problem. Dr. David Rubin of Philadelphia's Children's Hospital is the co-author of a new study suggesting that cuts to Medicaid would decrease access to mental health services for foster care children.
When you look at kids in foster care, you're talking about a population of kids, even among all kids in Medicaid, that are using 8 to 10 times the level of services as other kids in Medicaid. As a pediatrician, I give you the story of that child who suffered years of abuse and neglect, who comes into the system needing weekly counseling sessions for depression or anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder. Yet those weekly counseling sessions might get cut off if the EPSDT benefit is rolled back.
In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, there was speculation that Congress wouldn't enact major cuts to programs for the poor like Medicaid and food stamps, but it appears that sentiment has all but vanished on Capitol Hill. James Horney is an economist with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities.
So for a while, there was a thought that maybe the congressional leadership would not push ahead with the spending cuts in reconciliation. But then you started getting a lot of agitation from conservative pundits, conservative groups around Washington, and some of the most conservative members of the House and to some extent the Senate, who were saying, oh, the deficits are going to be higher as a result of all this spending that we're going to do for Katrina and Rita, and we need to offset that. And you started getting proposals for these offsets, and about 40% of the cuts they proposed would actually come in low-income programs.
Those in Congress looking to slash even more from what's known as discretionary spending were emboldened in their quest last week by President Bush.
I call on members to make real cuts in non-security spending.
While the House and Senate have agreed already to $35 billion in cuts to mostly programs for the poor, the House is expected to propose cutting an additional $15 billion later in the week. This while Congress is also on the verge in the same spending bill to enact tax cuts worth $70 billion. Again, James Horning.
This has been a lopsided process. The $35 billion that was assumed in the budget resolution cut entitlement programs, significant portion of that would come out of programs for low-income people. If they do more than $35 billion, it's very likely that the incremental amount up to $50 billion would come primarily out of programs for low-income people. On the other hand, the proposed tax cuts, the $70 billion in tax cuts to be achieved through reconciliation, would come overwhelmingly from cuts in taxes that would benefit the wealthiest Americans.
This week, the Senate takes up its budget reconciliation bill, and next week, the House will do the same. The cuts to Medicaid and other programs like food stamps are not a done deal. There are still some who think with hundreds of thousands of people still displaced due to the hurricane and heating bills likely to rise again, that now is not the time for such reductions. But their fight will be an uphill battle. Mitch Cheserich, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Explosive television ads called attention to Democratic Virginia governor's candidate Tim Kaine's position on the death penalty. Republican nominee Jerry Kilgore sparked a firestorm with a television ad featuring relatives of a murder victim, criticizing Kaine for representing a death row inmate and for once supporting a moratorium on executions in the state. Kaine, a Roman Catholic, said he has a faith-based objection to the death penalty, but would carry out executions unless an inmate can demonstrate his innocence. While there is no Catholic dogma that directly opposes the death penalty, there has been a long-standing divide between liberal and conservative Catholics on the issue. The nation's Roman Catholic bishops released a poll this spring touting the most comprehensive study of Catholic attitudes on capital punishment. It found that 48% of more than 1,700 Catholics surveyed support the death penalty, a drop from 2001 when the survey reported Catholic support for capital punishment at 68%.
Federal recognition of Indian tribes in Connecticut is being compounded by the hot-button issue of Indian gaming in the state. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs requires that a tribe seeking federal recognition meet seven requirements. One is that it must descend from a tribe of Native Americans that existed at the time when non-Indians made first sustained contact with the tribe.
It's amazingly difficult to put together a petition like the one that's required by the federal government. They want tribes like Skaticook to show for 350 years, on a substantially continuous basis, as they say in the regulations, that that tribe has continued to exist throughout time. 350 years.
That was Steve Austin, a cultural anthropologist who worked for the BIA for 7 years in the 1990s and then went to work as a private contractor for tribes all over the hemisphere. He worked on the petitions for both the Eastern Pequots and the Skaticooks, and says despite the difficulties, both tribes earned federal recognition in 2002 and 2004, respectively. But in its reversal last week, the BIA ruled that the tribes had failed to maintain a separate Indian community and exercise political authority over their members on a substantially continuous basis. All the state's top officials attacked the tribes for allying with wealthy backers who planned to establish casinos on the reservations if the tribes were federally acknowledged. Skaticook Chief Richard Velke says his tribal nation has been pursuing federal recognition for more than 20 years.
From 1981 to 1997, we did it on our own. Climate changed. And by the climate, I mean once gaming got involved in 1988, then the resistance started to attack the tribes seeking federal recognition. We have no other choice but to go out and find a financial backer or lose your identity. We weren't about to lose our identity.
With federal recognition comes the designation of a tribe as a, quote, semi-sovereign, dependent nation. This includes the possibility of establishing casinos as well as other types of economic development, including management of their natural resources. Recognition also grants a level of political autonomy, including electing leaders and running tribal courts. and it provides for educational scholarships for Native Americans, health services, and low-interest loans for housing and small businesses. The Scaticokes and Eastern Pequots charge that the bar was raised impossibly high on their applications in an effort to keep more casinos out of the state. And according to that standard, no tribe could get federal recognition. Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal disagrees.
The standard was exactly the same, that even if a more lenient standard had been applied, 150-year gaps in evidence on key criteria simply come nowhere near to meeting the standard.
The Eastern Pequots are still deciding whether to file a federal appeal, but Steve Austin says the Scaticokes are planning to appeal on the grounds that the ruling is arbitrary and capricious.
They've heightened the requirements beyond what they've ever required them to be before, and I think we should be able to establish that in federal court, which could lead to this being overturned. It's an uphill battle. Only one tribe has ever done this before and successfully. That was the Samish tribe in Washington State.
The state charged that casino interests wielded undue influence over the process and requested an investigation by the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, chaired by Senator John McCain. Blumenthal says a memorandum was uncovered indicating an irregularity in granting recognition, but no one was charged with wrongdoing. Now Chief Velke says McCain should conduct another investigation because the tribes are charging the state with undue influence.
He needs to have another hearing, but this time he needs the people on the hot seat from the state of Connecticut, not the tribes sitting in front of them.
For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
For the first time, stem cells have been harvested from embryos without killing them. This new technique could eventually provide children with personal store of spare part tissue for treating diseases later in life. The successful experiment in the United States paves the way for scientists to create a bank of master cells that are genetically identical to children before they are born. This should the child grow up and develop a disease such as diabetes or Parkinson's, the cells could be used for therapy. It also promises to address one of the strongest ethical objections to the embryonic stem cell research, that the cells have great medical potential as they can form any type of tissue in the human body. Their use is opposed by religious groups, however, because they can only be extracted by destroying embryos. If the new procedure, tested so far only in mice, also works in human beings, it will allow researchers to obtain embryonic stem cells from embryos that remain intact and could go on to become children.
The current time is 5:32, and now, on today's Earthwatch Report, how freshwater species are coping with saltwater intrusions.
Shippers use shock therapy to clear stowaways out of ballast water. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Sailors are using salinity shock to fight the plants and animals that ride in ballast water on their ships. Even the tiniest stowaway can cause problems if it's dumped into a foreign port, and shippers are using salt water on the high seas to kill these organisms. David Reed is a scientist at the Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's studied the invasion of the Great Lakes by plants and animals that traveled in ocean-going freighters. Reed says there's a reason why freshwater organisms get into the ballast water of ocean-going ships. A lot of seaports are located where rivers meet the coastline, and the river water can be full of freshwater plants and animals. When ships take on ballast water in these ports, they can pick up a lot of freshwater hitchhikers as well. Reed says shippers are trying to get rid of these hitchhikers and keep them out of the Great Lakes. They dump their freshwater ballast at sea and take on a new load of saltwater. Reed says that does two things. First, it clears out a lot of the plants and animals that were along for the ride.
You also expose any that stay in the tank. You expose them to a much higher salinity, and the idea is that the salinity shock should kill them or at least reduce their ability to reproduce.
Reed says this shock therapy is fairly effective, but it's not perfect. He says more work needs to be done to stop the spread of plants and animals that ride in the ballast water of ships.
You don't want to impose policies that are based on a knee-jerk response without knowing that you have a good scientific basis for implementing those policies. And at the same time, we have the problem that until we do something, these species are continuing to be brought to North America on a regular basis.
Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
George W. Bush's top political advisor, Karl Rove, testified at length on Friday before a grand jury. This is the fourth time Rove testified in a case investigating the leak of a covert CIA operative's identity. Rove spent 4.5 hours at the federal courthouse and was told by prosecutors they had yet to decide whether he should face charges. Prosecutors have told Rove that they cannot guarantee that he would not be indicted. When pressed by reporters, White House spokesman Scott McClellan could not explicitly repeat past expressions of confidence in Rove, who serves as deputy chief of staff and senior advisor. People close to the case said Rove's unusually lengthy grand jury appearance on Friday suggested prosecutors scrutinizing his earlier testimony for inconsistencies and confronted him with new information from witnesses. The outcome of the investigation could shake up an administration already reeling from criticism over its Hurricane Katrina response. The indictment of House of Representatives leader Tom DeLay of Texas for charges on related to campaign financing and on the Senate Republican leader Bill Frist's SEC investigation.
The current time is 5:35. And now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
A lot of Americans are hard hit these days. There's the devastation suffered by hurricane victims, of course, and the Census Bureau reports that America's poverty rate has risen for the fourth consecutive year, adding nearly 6 million more people to the poverty rolls since 2000, despite a growing economy. But for a truly sad tale of economic woe, consider the plight of Bill Bosworth. Bill is a Republican partisan who was appointed to a state judgeship just 2 years ago. But recently, he wrote to our GOP governor begging for a judicial pay raise because, he said, the job was causing financial hardships for him. He pleaded that, quote, absent the increase, I do not know that I will be able to continue the sacrifice. Bill, you see, was only making $108,000 a year. Need a hanky? Bill and other state judges wail that judicial pay has not increased since 1997. Gosh, how ironic. That's also the last time the minimum wage was increased. Millions of full-time workers on minimum wage are still stuck at $5.15 an hour, but the judges didn't think to include these poverty wage workers in their plea for government relief. Nor did the judges waste any of their tears on the state's teachers, who were denied a long-overdue pay raise by this year's legislative leaders. Instead, the judges stayed focused on number one, lobbying only for themselves. Bosworth, noting that he could pull down $40,000 more than he's getting as a judge by returning to private practice, said almost tearfully, "You have to evaluate how much sacrifice you're willing to make." Yeah, Bill, those of us paying your salary feel your pain. But the governor relieved his pain by signing a bill jumping judges' pay to $125,000 a year, three times the income of average Texans. This is Jim Hightower saying, and the powers that be wonder why ordinary folks think these political elites are self-dealing slugs. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6, stay tuned for Labor Radio. Tonight's host, Dan McIntosh, will interview the head of the Workers' Rights Consortium. The student-led anti-sweatshop group is in Portland tonight to speak on a conference on human rights. Labor Radio will also feature a report from the National Center for Responsive Philanthropy criticizing Walmart and some of the accounts of from today's AFL-CIO convention. At 7 o'clock, it's Time Sound with Kevin Berry. Tonight's weather, partly sunny with a low of 52 degrees. Tomorrow, intermittent clouds with a high of 64. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
George W. Bush told British Prime Minister Tony Blair 2 months before the invasion of Iraq that he had designs on other countries as well. Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Iran, and North Korea were mentioned in a top-secret Downing Street memo naming countries that could be dealt with over weapons of mass destruction. This is according to The Independent. The U.S. president told Tony Blair in a secret telephone conversation in January 2003 that he wanted to go beyond Iraq. He implied that the military action against Saddam Hussein was only a first step in the battle against WMD proliferation in a series of countries. The confidential memo recording the president's explosive remarks was written by Michael Rycroft, then the prime minister's private secretary and foreign policy advisor.
Iraqis took to the poll this weekend amid relative calm, and the residents voted on the country's draft constitution. Vote counting continues, and early results indicate Shiite-dominated areas backing the charter, while Sunni provinces appear to have largely cast votes against it. FSRN's Salam Talib spoke with Moeed al-Hamadi, an Iraqi journalist living in Baghdad, about this weekend's referendum.
What are people hoping the new constitution will accomplish?
Americans are always saying that a civil war will erupt if the constitution fails. But now the people, especially in Mosul, are afraid that the Americans will cause the constitution to fail. In many cities, Americans have taken the voting boxes to U.S. bases. For example, in Diyala, they took Khalakin, Jeola, and Al-Sadia's votes to be counted in the U.S. military base, called Cobra.
What your expectation as Iraqi about who will vote yes for the constitution?
The constitution was accepted by people in the south and was refused by the Sunni Arabs. Now we see the reverse. The south does not accept the constitution for two main reasons. First, they do not trust the government anymore after they decided to change the constitution in the last 48 hours. So now the writers of the constitution put in the document that it will not be the same for the next 8 years. Instead, the parliament can change it any time they want. Americans pushed the government to change the constitution at the last minute. So why should the people trust the constitution? The government changed the constitution and almost wiped out the reason for having a constitution in the first place. They redefined the definition of an Iraqi voter. So now even foreigners can be defined as Iraqis.
The U.S. military said today that strikes by U.S. warplanes and helicopters on two villages west of Baghdad had killed 70 militants. Witnesses claim there were many civilians among the dead, this according to The Guardian. The strikes took place yesterday in the Ramadi area. The strikes came in response to a roadside bomb that killed five U.S. soldiers in the nearby village of Al-Abaid on Saturday. The U.S. military said warplanes and helicopters attacked after a crowd of Iraqis had gathered at the site of the wreckage a day after the bombing. The crowd was believed to be insurgents trying to set up another bomb in the immediate area. But several witnesses and one local leader said the people were civilians who had gathered to look at the wreckage of the U.S. vehicle or take pieces off of it. Local tribal leader Shahid Saad and other witnesses said the strikes killed 25 witnesses.
Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe today railed against U.S. President George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair, calling them international terrorists bent on world domination like Adolf Hitler. Mugabe departed from his text at a ceremony marking the 60th anniversary of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. He accused Bush and Blair of illegally invading Iraq and looking to unseat governments elsewhere. Mugabe accuses Britain and the United States of working to unseat him over his forcible redistribution of white-owned commercial farms among blacks. The situation has helped plunge his country into the worst economic crisis since independence from Britain in 1980. But U.S. Ambassador Tony Hall protested against Mugabe's presence at the celebrations. Hall later told Reuters it was very unfortunate that the Zimbabwean leader had politicized the event that was supposed to draw attention to world hunger.
The 15th Ibero-American Summit was held in Spain over the weekend. Speakers at the summit called for an end to the U.S. blockade against Cuba and for the extradition to Venezuela of Luis Posada Carriles, who is wanted for the bombing of a Cuban airliner. FSRN's Joseph Muti has more from Havana.
The meeting in Salamanca ended with a resolution that included the statement, "We ask the government of the United States of America to put an end to the economic, commercial, and financial blockade that it maintains against Cuba." This was the first time that the 22-nation summit used the term blockade to refer to Washington's efforts to economically isolate Cuba. Havana insists that blockade rather than embargo is the right connotation because the U.S. continuously attempts to prevent other nations from trading with the island. The leaders of Spain, Portugal, and most of the nations of Latin America now agree, as does Walter Lippmann, who edits a Los Angeles-based electronic international news service on Cuba.
The outcome at Salamanca was extremely significant for two reasons. First of all, because the delegates used the term blockade rather than the sanitized term embargo, the term blockade is in fact more accurate a reflection of what is actually happening as the United States attempts to impose its own unilateral policies on the rest of the world.
A special communique by the summit also approved a Cuban-backed resolution on terrorism in which the summit nations supported steps to, quote, achieve the extradition or bring to justice the person responsible for the terrorist attack on a Cubana de Aviación plane in October 1976, which killed 73 civilians, unquote. The communique was referring to Luis Posada Carriles, a former CIA agent who is currently in U.S. custody for immigration violations. A U.S. judge has refused to extradite him. Venezuela seeks his extradition because he holds Venezuelan citizenship and the bombed plane originated in Caracas. Along with his co-conspirator, Orlando Bosch, Posada Carriles is characterized by the FBI as a terrorist, but received the protection of George Bush Sr. Cubans now see Bush Jr. continuing his father's protection of perhaps the most reviled man in the nation's history. Walter Lippmann.
In addition to using terminology which more accurately reflects the situation, the summit's decision to call for the extradition of the terrorist responsible for the bombing of the Cubana airliner in 1976 was also very important because this was the first time that this prestigious international body had publicly taken this position, or indeed any position, in relation to this terrorist act.
Summit participants also expressed their profound concern for the pardon of Posada Carriles by a former Panamanian president with ties to the Miami Cuban exile community after he and three others had been found guilty of explosives charges related to an attempt on the life of Cuban President Fidel Castro during a previous Ibero-American summit. José de León is one of the some 100 low-income U.S. students studying medicine for free in Cuba. He said that given the history of Miami-based aggression against Cuba, the statement relating to Posada Carriles was very important.
I think it's important, the request to extradite Posada Carriles, because this has been something that has hugely ignored for several decades, and it's being brought into international light, and it's being supported internationally as well, because this is also bringing attention to the hypocrisy of the United States war against terrorism, because this is a man who basically has self-proclaimed himself as a terrorist.
After the resolution was passed, Cuba's foreign minister, Felipe Perez Roque, commented that on top of the important decision to include the word blockade in the resolution and the subsequent communique on Posada Carriles, he was surprised that not a single head of state or foreign minister defended the Washington unrestricted free market and privatization policies seen by his government as so destructive for Latin America and the Caribbean. In Havana for Free Speech Radio, I'm Joseph Mutti.
Two strong undersea earthquakes shook a major port city in western Turkey today. The quakes damaged buildings, prompting terrified residents to run from their homes and jump from windows. At least six people were injured, officials and news reports said. The quakes, which registered the preliminary magnitudes of 5.7 and 5.9, struck at 8:45 a.m. and 12:47 p.m. Both were centered in the Bay of Sagassak, about 30 miles southwest of the Aegean port city of Izmir, Turkey's third largest city with a population of about 3 million. There was no immediate reports of damage in the ancient city of Ephesus, about 60 miles south of Izmir. The quake collapsed walls in some houses and shattered windows in Urla, west of Izmir. The second quake caused further damage, smashing windows, some witnesses said. Scientists warned there could be more quakes and aftershocks during the next few days and urged residents to stay away from damaged buildings.
The death toll in the October 8th earthquake in Kashmir has soared to over 50,000. The Prime Minister of Pakistan, administered Kashmir, said the toll could rise to 70,000. Cut off by landslides, many affected villages are still inaccessible on both sides of Kashmir. Bad weather is adding to the difficulties of rescuers and survivors alike. From Srinagar, FSRN's Shahnawaz Khan reports.
Rain and snowfall in most parts of divided Kashmir over the weekend added to the miseries of people rendered homeless by the killer quake on October 8. On Sunday, six Pakistani army personnel engaged in relief operations were killed in a helicopter crash, reportedly due to bad weather. Incessant rains hampered the relief and rescue operations and threatened more casualties among the homeless in Kashmir. 9 days after the quake, hundreds of thousands of people are without any shelter. Facing a severe shortage, Pakistan is asking other countries to donate tents. It has even lifted an import ban on tents from India. The government in Indian-administered Kashmir says it has managed to distribute around 7,000 tents, although it needs more than 40,000. The government in Indian Kashmir today started distributing cash relief among the quake victims to help people find housing before the harsh winter. As winter snowfalls approach and the temperatures drop, time is already running out for those left homeless by the earthquake. For Free CB Tribal News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has turned down a request by Lebanon to extend an inquiry into the death of its former prime minister. Annan said he wanted to see the report on Rafiq Hariri's assassination due this Friday before granting an extension. Lebanon formally asked last week that the UN team investigating the killing be given more time. Hariri was killed in February in a massive bomb blast in Beirut that also killed 20 other people. Annan said today he wanted to deal with the investigation on a purely technical basis, but was determined to not allow politicization of the process. Syria, the main power in Lebanon until its military withdrawal earlier this year, has been blamed by many Lebanese for the assassination, but denies any involvement. However, UN investigator Detlev Melis has listed four probable Syrian Lebanese general as suspects and questioned seven Syrian officials.
Violence has escalated in the West Bank on the eve of a meeting between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and President George Bush. FSRN's Manar Jabrin reports.
Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mufaz decided to resume military incursions and to impose restrictions on the movement of Palestinians in the West Bank after three Israeli settlers were killed during a drive-by shooting on Sunday. The shooting occurred near the West Bank cities of Bethlehem and Nablus. Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigades, the armed wing of Fatah ruling party, claimed responsibility for the attacks. On Monday morning, Israeli army troops arrested 18 Palestinians wanted in connection with the shooting. Israel decided to suspend all communications with the Palestinian Authority, including a planned meeting between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon that was scheduled for early November. President Abbas is expected to meet with the United States President George Bush on Thursday. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jabrin.
Human rights representatives and government officials have opened an investigation into what caused this weekend's fire at a Buenos Aires prison. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
At least 32 prisoners died from asphyxiation during a fire in the Magdalena State Penitentiary in the Buenos Aires province over the weekend. According to the provincial government's official version, the fire broke out during a fight between prison inmates that escalated into a jail riot late Saturday night. Prisoners from the neighboring ward rescued the survivors and dragged out all of the bodies they could find. Just days before the deaths, lawyers from the National Commission Against Torture visited 10 inmates staging a hunger strike to demand humane conditions inside the Magdalena State Penitentiary ward. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
All right, yeehaw, and that's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 17, 2005. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Julie Sabatier. Our assistant producer is Noah Eaton, who is also tonight's audio editor. Special thanks to reporters Noah Eaton and Stephanie Potter. Our engineer is John Delderfield. The KBOO Interim Evening News and Public Affairs Directors are Jamie Heim and Julie Sabatier. I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Andy Seaton. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 a.m., here are the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host Talk Radio. At 9, special program featuring an extended interview with John Perkins, authors of A Confession of an Economic Hitman. Perkins was a respected member of the international banking community. He says he helped the U.S. cheat poor countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars by lending them more money than they could possibly repay and then taking over their economies. At 10:30, on stage and studio, hear Imago Theater's production of Carolyn Churchill's Not Enough Oxygen, and three women discuss their experiences with breast cancer. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! It's all right here on KBOO, your community, nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored radio station. Thanks for joining us.
Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Thousands of visitors are arriving in Fairbanks, Alaska this week for the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention, the state's largest Native gathering. AFN formed nearly 40 years ago to advocate for Native land rights. As INN's Libby Casey reports, now the organization and its annual conference have grown to encompass the cultural, economic, and political issues of Alaska's Native people.
The Alaska Federation of Natives is the state's largest Native organization. Members include 178 villages, 13 regional Native corporations, and a dozen regional nonprofit and tribal consortiums. This year's gathering is split into three parts. The two-day Elders and Youth Conference starts Monday and includes lectures from community leaders, cultural performances, and workshops at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Then on Wednesday, AFN hosts the Alaska Marketplace Economic Forum. AFN Senior Vice President Mike Irwin says it's a brand new project.
It's basically an entrepreneurial contest, if you will, that's modeled after something that the World Bank's been doing throughout the third world.
Irwin says competition participants will come up with an idea for a product or service unique to Alaska that could be introduced into the marketplace. The ideas will be presented at a later time, and winners will get cash prizes to fund their projects. The actual AFN convention kicks off Thursday. Mike Irwin says during the day, delegates will take care of business, such as voting in board members and discussing resolutions.
One of the highlights is the Saturday resolutions process, where the delegates basically set the Native agenda for the coming year through debate and passage of resolutions.
Evenings will include the Koyana Festival, which features dance, drumming, and singing performances. AFN also hosts one of the state's biggest Native arts and crafts fairs. Organizers hope the week will bring Alaska Natives together and give non-Native Alaskans a chance to share and celebrate the culture. In Fairbanks, I'm Libby Casey.
The intervention of a Washington congressman has failed to end a standoff between a tiny northwest coastal tribe and the National Park Service. The tribe wants to move part of its village of La Push out of the tsunami zone. Correspondent Tom Bonzi has more.
The Quileute tribe hopes to rebuild its school, senior center, offices, and some housing on safer, higher ground on land that belongs to the Olympic National Park. To get attention, the tribe earlier this month closed access to two beautiful ocean beaches. Democratic Washington Congressman Norm Dix asked the tribal council to reconsider. They did on Friday. The tribal paralegal Paul Sywell says the beach trailhead and parking lot will stay closed until the Quileutes get an acceptable land offer. Olympic Park spokeswoman Barb Main says a solution may lie beyond the Park Service's power.
Quite a bit. 95% of Olympic National Park is designated as wilderness. To undesignate wilderness requires an act of Congress. Whether that's the ultimate solution is not yet known.
The tiny Quileute Indian Reservation is mostly hemmed in by a river, the ocean, and the national park. Representative Dick's office says Congress could help by moving boundaries or budgeting money to buy private property somewhere outside the tsunami zone. I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
Native youth between the ages of 15 and 24 are more than three times likely to commit suicide than any other youth nationwide. A Native Youth Crisis Hotline based in St. Paul, Minnesota, was started in August, and organizers say the enormous number of calls from all over the U.S. and Canada has prompted instituting a national crisis hotline in order to spread the word and draw awareness to the new service. A six-day, three-state run will begin October 18th. The Honor the Youth Spiritual Run 2 will leave the Red Lake Reservation in Minnesota after a celebration tonight, ending at Fort Yates on the Standing Rock Reservation in South Dakota on October 23rd, expanding staff, training, and funding to meet the needs of Native youth in the form of this hotline has been supported by the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, as well as the National Congress of American Indians. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.